Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 870, the Underground Reich and Indonesia. This is being recorded on October 25th of the year 2015. In some of our landmark discussions with Peter Lavenda, the brilliant author of The Hitler Legacy, Unholy Alliance, and Ratline, we have spoken about a number of topics, including the profound Nazi presence in Indonesia. That presence goes back well before the Second World War. It was maintained during the Second World War and continued in the post-World War II era as well. Indonesia is not only the world's most populous Muslim country, it is the fourth most populous nation on earth. It also has tremendous natural resources, including oil and rubber. The discussions with Peter Lavenda for the record program 838 through 846, and then 864 and 865 talk about, well, we talk about many things, but the Nazi presence in Indonesia is one of those. Indonesia had been a Dutch colony in the pre-World War II period. The Netherlands itself had a large Nazi party, which in turn had a branch in Indonesia before World War II. In addition, Walter Havel, H-E-W-E-L, one of Hitler's closest associates, a participant in the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923, and someone who remained very close to Hitler and was in the Führerbunker in Berlin up until the last moments before the Russian capture or the Soviet capture of Berlin in World War II. Walter Havel had the nickname of Surabaya Wali, and he had profound connections in Indonesia. Indonesia received counseling from Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht in the post-war period. It was the focal point of profound amounts of Golden Lily loot from not only the Japanese Golden Lily program, but also a lot of Nazi loot was transferred to Indonesia as well. Specifically, Nazi gold was transferred to Indonesia in the post-World War II period. The aforementioned Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht appears to have transferred a lot of money to the regime of President Sukarno, and that apparently was involved with his revolutionary fund. Eventually, however, because Sukarno insisted on a neutralist path and was not willing to crack down on the Communist Party of Indonesia, he was not himself a communist nor a communist sympathizer. However, he saw the communist presence in Indonesia as simply one of a number of political elements to be essentially tolerated as part of a de facto coalition. Sukarno wished to remain neutral, and because of that, he fell afoul of not only hardcore cold warriors, but the intelligence services of both the U.S. and what was then West Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany. Among others, Charles Willoughby, Carl Adolf von Zschäpe und Wiedenbach, the German-born fascist who was Douglas MacArthur's G2 during World War II, his top military intelligence officer, saw the primarily Muslim country of Indonesia as a Muslim bulwark, a potential Muslim bulwark in Asia against the expansion of communist China. When, again, Sukarno insisted on remaining neutral between the U.S. or the West and the Soviet Union. This basically placed him on the wrong side of the Dulles brothers. The Dulles brothers, John Foster and Allen Dulles, were respectively the Secretary of State and the head of the CIA under President Dwight Eisenhower. And, of course, both Dulles brothers had been prominent attorneys with Sullivan and Cromwell, the powerful Wall Street law firm, and had been deeply involved with many of the machinations that helped to elevate German finance and industry in the pre-World War II period, and that elevation had much to do with enabling Germany's rearmament and the prosecution of World War II from a military standpoint. Allen Dulles was deeply involved with the Galen Organization and the SS in the post-World War II period. John Foster Dulles was a major champion of German rearmament and was very, very close to the Konrad Adenauer regime in Germany. To get an idea of what that regime was like, I refer interested listeners to the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens, and also For the Record program number 768, What the Hell Does Dave Emery Mean by Underground Reich? That was about the Werner Naumann coup of 1953, essentially behind a relatively thin democratic facade. Nazis remained in power of the primary German institutions in the post-World War II period, although the German citizenry was by no means Nazi. The centers of power, the finance, industry, the intelligence services, the courts, and the military remained in the hands of World War II Nazis, and their finance and industry were controlled by the post-World War II Galen or Bormann Capital Network. When, again, Sukarno chose a path of neutralism, he became the focal point for a massive covert operation. It was almost an overt operation. Tremendous American resources were devoted to overthrowing Sukarno, naval units, military units involving Air Force and Marines, as well as a huge CIA presence were involved in attempting to dislodge Sukarno, because again, his neutralism was seen by the Dulles brothers and the West as basically being sympathetic to communism. Ultimately, the initial coup attempts under Operation Archipelago, as it became noted, failed. However, the attempts to overthrow Sukarno continued. And finally, in 1965, there was a huge bloody coup in Indonesia that overthrew Sukarno, replaced him with General Suharto, S-U-H-A-R-T-O, and resulted in the slaughter of millions of people. There have been a couple, hundreds of thousands, possibly a million, possibly more people. There have been a couple of recent documentaries about the murderers in that coup, and in addition to members of the Indonesian Communist Party, basically anyone viewed with disfavor by the Indonesian army, that being writers, social critics, artists, and free thinkers, just about anybody who did not agree with the right-wing military mindset of the Indonesian army was liquidated or imprisoned in Indonesia. Again, the actual death total was huge, maybe up to a million, possibly more. There has never been a precise accounting. I remember reading an account of someone who was sailing in the waters around the Indonesian island of Bali, the focal point of the song Bali High, and I believe it was the musical South Pacific by Richard Rogers. And the slaughter had been so thorough and so intense that the waters around Bali were filled with floating and oftentimes headless corpses because the victims had been beheaded. That will give people something of the flavor of the 1965 Indonesian coup. General Suharto remained in power until the late 1990s, and a recent issue of GermanForeignPolicy.com reveals that the 65 coup was not just a CIA operation, but received profound assistance from the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, the final incarnation of the Reinhard Gehlen Eastern Front spy outfit about which we have spoken so often. Not only was the BND deeply involved with that coup, but the apparent BND station chief in Indonesia at that time, using a journalistic cover, basically for the Süddeutsche Zeitung and Neue Zürcher Zeitung, was a fellow named Rudolf Obscher Rader. That's O-E-B-S-G-E-R, Obscher Rader, O-E-B-S-G-E-R, as in Roger hyphen R, O-Umlaut D-E-R. Rudolf Obscher Rader was a former colonel in the SS. He worked for the RSHA, the Reich Sicherheitshauptamt. That was the High Bureau of Reich Security in Nazi Germany. And like so many SS and Gestapo men, he went to work for the BND in the post-World War II period. And so, again, as we are about to read in this GermanForeignPolicy.com article, the BND was deeply involved with the 1965 Indonesian coup. And again, their apparent BND station chief at this time was a former colonel in the SS. From GermanForeignPolicy.com of October 15th of 2015, we read Bonn and the Putsch. Bonn, of course, the former capital of the Federal Republic of Germany, B-O-N-N. The article reads, Germany's Federal Intelligence Service, or BND, had been heavily involved in the 1965 murderous Putsch in Indonesia, which is the guest nation of this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. This was confirmed in secret documents from the Bundestag, the German parliament. According to the BND's chief at that time, Gerhard Wessel, a manuscript he delivered in a session of the Bundestag's confidential committee in June of 1968 reveals that the BND did more than merely support the Indonesian military in their blood-soaked liquidation of the CPI, unquote, the Communist Party of Indonesia, resulting in the murder of hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions. The BND assisted with advisors, equipment, and finances. Suharto, who subsequently took power, have even attributed, quote, a large part of the success of the operation to the BND. Up to now, mostly the U.S. and American assistance to the Putsch has been known. The Putsch and the more than 30-year-long dictatorship that followed, which also had been reliably promoted by West Germany, are important themes being presented by Indonesian writers at this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. To this day, the German government has refused to allow an investigation of the BND's support for the Putsch and the Indonesian military's excessive brutality.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
The Indonesian Putsch, bringing Major General Haji Muhammad Suharto, the power in Jakarta, began in October 1965 as a reaction to an attempted coup d'etat, which killed several officers on September 30th. Suharto's dictatorial reign lasted until 1998. The attempted coup was falsely attributed to the Communist Party of Indonesia, or CPI. Subsequently, the military launched excessively brutal operations against all genuine and suspected members and sympathizers of the Communist Party. Hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions, were murdered, and millions more were imprisoned. The exact number of killed and imprisoned is still unknown. The crimes committed at the time by the military have never really been brought to light. One of the things never brought to light is what support Western powers had given to the Suharto putsch. U.S. complicity, having had the best relationship to the Indonesian armed forces, has to some extent already been exposed. According to experts, for example, by 1965, around 4,000 Indonesian officers had been trained in U.S. military installations, as well as high-ranking officers having been trained in counterinsurgency on the basis of U.S. field manuals at Indonesia's elite military institutes. On December 2nd of 1965, the U.S. ambassador gave his consent to providing financial support to the COP Gestapo movement, a movement, as he put it, inspired by the army, even though comprised of civilian action groups, unquote, which, quote, shouldered the task of the ongoing repressive measures against Indonesia's Communist Party. By the way, I would note that the COP Gestapo is spelled G-E-S-T-A-P-U, almost certainly derived from Gestapo, and I think we will be able to fairly clearly see why in just a minute. And again, that was the political movement of the generals, which basically gave rise to the slaughter in Indonesia, again called the COP Gestapo movement, G-E-S-T-A-P-U. Returning to the text of this GermanForeignPolicy.com article of October 15th, the U.S. ambassador must have known what this support for the movement would mean. On November 13th, his employees had passed on information from the Indonesian police indicating that, quote, between 50 and 100 members of the CPI in eastern and central Java were being killed each night. April 15th, the embassy had admitted, quote, it did not know if the actual number of murdered CPI activists, quote, was not closer to 100,000 or 1 million, unquote. In spite of the mass murder, the U.S. ambassador in Jakarta reported back to Washington on August 10th of 1966 that the authorities in Jakarta had been provided a list of leading CPI members by the U.S. Agencies of the West German government had also been involved in the coup. The BND had supported, quote, Indonesia's military intelligence services' 1965 defeat of a left-wing putsch in Jakarta with submachine guns, shortwave radios, and money, with a total value of 300,000 Deutschmarks, reported Der Spiegel in March of 1971. 12 weeks later, the magazine added that, quote, a commando of BND men, unquote, had again, quoting, trained military intelligence service operatives in Indonesia and relieved their CIA colleagues who were under the heavy pressure of anti-American propaganda, unquote. By, quote, supplying Soviet rifles and Finnish ammunition, the BND instructors were even actually intervening in that civil war. If one can believe the BND's founder, Reinhard Gehlen, Bonn at the time had the best contacts to leading military officers in Indonesia. In his memoirs published in 1971, Galen wrote, quote, "Two of Germany's reliable friends were among the Indonesian officers murdered September 30th, including, quote, the longtime and highly revered military attaché in Bonn, Brigadier General Pandjaitan, P-A-N-D-J-A-I-T-A-N, unquote. During the putsch, the BND, quote, was in the fortunate position of being able to provide the West German government with timely and detailed reports from excellent sources on the progress of those days, which had been so crucial for Indonesia," unquote. Other indications have emerged from the research published by the expert of intelligence services, Eric Schmidt Eienboom, that last name, S-C-H-M-I-D-T hyphen, E-E-N-B-O-O-M as in Mary, and the political scientist Matthias Ritzi, R-I-T-Z-I. Their findings confirmed that there was close cooperation between the BND and the CIA in the Indonesian coup. In April of 1961, BND headquarters in Pulak had informed the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency that it had, quote, an excellent chief of station, unquote, in Jakarta, writes Schmidt Eienboom. The CIA thought the BND was referring to Rudolf Obscher Rader, O-E-B-S-G-E-R hyphen R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T D-E-R, a former colonel of the SS, working in the Reich Security Central Office, or Reich Sicherheitshauptamt in Nazi Germany, who joined West Germany's organization Galen in 1948 and was later on post in Indonesia as a correspondent for the Süddeutsche Zeitung and the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. In mid-January of 1960, the BND had maintained Obscher Rader on its staff until the mid-1960s. In mid-January of 1964, a high-ranking CIA representative paid Galen a visit and asked him how the West Germans were handling the developments in Indonesia, explained Schmidt Eienboom and Ritzi. Galen told him that he is keeping Bonn up to date, but does not yet know how the Chancellery intends to proceed. The manuscript for a talk BND President Gerhard Wessel presented on June 21st, 1968, to the Bundestag's Confidential Committee provides more details. In the form of notes, Wessel gave, quote, details of BND activities, unquote, in support of its Indonesian partner service, explained Schmidt Eienboom and Ritzi. Explicitly, the manuscript explains that, quote, the close ties already in place to the Indonesian Strategic ND, or Intelligence Service, by October of 1965 had facilitated support with advisors, equipment, and money to Indonesia's intelligence service and its special military organs during the elimination of the CPI and Sukarno's disempowerment, control, and support of demonstrations. The CPI's elimination, unquote, included the assassination of hundreds of thousands of genuine and suspected members and sympathizers of the Indonesian CP. According to the manuscript, BND President Wessel continued his speech to the Confidential Committee, quote, in the opinion of Indonesian politicians and military officers, Suharto, Nasution, N-A-S-Q-T-I-O-N, and Sultan, S-U-L-T-A-N, in large part thanks to the BND. Reflecting back, BND founder Galen was praising these crimes almost effusively. Quote, the significance of the Indonesian Party's success, which pursued the elimination of the entire Communist Party with all consequences and severity, cannot, in my opinion, be praised highly enough, Galen wrote in his 1971 memoirs. By the way, the introduction to that book, Galen's autobiography, was by David Irving, the noted Holocaust denier. Continuing. The German government is still refusing to shed light on Germany's participation in these crimes. In the parliamentary interpolation, the government was asked if it has knowledge of foreign governments, intelligence services, or other organizations' direct or indirect support of the massacres, unquote. In May of 2014, it responded, quote, after a thorough assessment, the government concludes that it cannot give an open answer, unquote. It is, quote, imperative, unquote, to keep the requested information, unquote, secret. The protection of sources, unquote, is a, quote, principle of primary importance to the work of intelligence services. For the German government, the Indonesian civil society's need to have information on foreign support for the immense mass murder is of less importance than its protection of sources, unquote. I would note in passing that these events took place half a century ago. So again, profound BND participation with the Indonesian coup, the core group of the officers' movement that led to the coup was called the KAP Gestapo, G-E-S-T-A-P-U, just like Gestapo, only with a U at the end, movement. And not only was the BND and the Galen organization deeply involved, but Rudolf Obscher Raeder, a former SS colonel and the apparent BND station chief in Indonesia at the time, was apparently the point man for the BND effort at that time. For the bulk of the rest of this program, I'm going to be wandering fairly far afield from what we would normally examine, and we're going to take a look at what is emphatically a speculative element. We're going to be reading a section of a chapter called Waltzing the Enigma from a book called True Hallucinations by Terence McKenna. Terence McKenna was an advocate for hallucinogenic drugs that he felt could be of considerable benefit in personal enlightenment. That is, of course, a long way from home for this program. However, while he was in Indonesia as part of a global search to research hallucinogenic drugs, Terence McKenna came across a fellow whom he names Dr. Carl Heinz, H-E-I-N-T-Z. This was a German who was an official with a German mining corporation and had been using advanced scientific techniques to unearth mineral riches in Indonesia. Beyond that, it was apparent from the text here that the individual called Dr. Carl Heinz was working with something that is very much akin to, and I suspect was, in fact, the Borman Capital Network. Now, I would stress that this is an anecdotal account. I would note that Terence McKenna later came across this fellow at a conference in Colorado. The fellow went to considerable lengths, as we will see, to mask his identity and denied wholeheartedly having met Terence McKenna in Indonesia. The cruise ship that is referred to here, the SS Rotterdam, was in fact a real cruise ship, and whether or not all of the details in Terence McKenna's account here are accurate, this is a compelling anecdote. And if, in fact, it is accurate, it not only shows us the ongoing depth of German Nazi presence in Indonesia, but the operations, it offers a window into some of the colors, so to speak, of the post-war operations of the Bormann Capital Network. Eventually, learning that Terence McKenna was hoping to go to Latin America, Dr. Karl Heinz, who had gotten fairly lit up on schnapps, offered to take Terence McKenna to the Amazon with his team. We're going to ruminate some more about this. I would note that ultimately Terence McKenna died of a brain tumor. His archives were housed at the Esalen Institute in Central California, really down in the Monterey Bay area. However, they were destroyed in a fire a number of years ago. So any further research into this speculative element, well, it cannot be conducted. So for what it is worth, from the book True Hallucinations by Terence McKenna, and from the chapter Waltzing the Enigma. By the way, that book was published by Harper Press in San Francisco in copyright 1993. So from the chapter Waltzing the Enigma, from True Hallucinations by Terence McKenna, we offer up this. Now, was this a hallucination or a true hallucination? That remains to be seen.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
The manager here has told me of your biological researches on Timor. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Dr. Karl Heinz, H-E-I-N-T-Z, of Far Eastern Mining and Minerals Incorporated. My relief was immediate. Obviously, this guy wasn't some kind of Interpol porker come to track me down, but he had that look. He was powerfully built, with swept back iron gray hair and strikingly intense eyes of glacial blue. He sported a Schmiss, S-C-H-M-I-S-S, on his left cheek, a long, thin scar. I had never seen a Schmiss before, but the crossword puzzle term sprang into my mind unbidden. I wondered if he had received it in the traditional manner in a sword duel that is part of the hazings that go on in the university fraternities of Prussia. Quote, as we are the only guests here at Rama Hotel, may I invite you to join my wife and I for some schnapps. I am keen to hear your perceptions concerning Timor, unquote. The town was too small for me to refuse gracefully. Had I said no, we would have ended up at separate tables in the same five-table restaurant. I hated the idea of spending time with straight people, but there seemed no decent way to escape. Hearing him speak brought his wife into the small foyer to join us. She made the decision easier, though I was careful to guard my reaction of amazement. Only a year or two older than myself, maybe 25, she was stunningly beautiful, dark, sari-clad, that's S-A-R-I-clad, with huge, fawn-like eyes, a gold nose ring, and many bracelets. In that tropical backwater, her appearance was as unlikely as a flying saucer. She was a vision of overdressed, Brahmanic perfection. Her name was Rani, R-A-N-I, and when she spoke, her voice was cultivated and musical. Though she rarely spoke, her English was better than his. This was no girl from the Indian villages, and I confess that I was intrigued. What could I do but accompany this pair? It wasn't as though I had anything better to do. Once we were seated at the restaurant with our quart beer bottles of Bintang beer in front of us, the conversation began to flow, and I started to form an impression of my companions. Dr. Heinz was, he said, a geologist with an outfit in Singapore. The year before, a survey team had found evidence of a large deposit of nickel that straddled the border between Indonesian and Portuguese Timor. He was there to confirm their findings and to estimate the feasibility of a mining operation. That seemed straightforward enough, although there were references to a set of instruments that could somehow determine the true size of the deposit. I knew very little of prospecting technology, but the device that could see hundreds of feet into the ground sounded far-fetched to me. I gently inquired about the language that I had heard them both speaking, thinking that this would lead him on to discussing his wife. It turned out to be a favorite subject of his. She was, he told me while she merely sat and watched us both, a granddaughter of the Maharani of Maharashtra. It seemed that Heinz had been in the market for a few hundred acres of prime Maharashtrian agricultural land, and the old Maharani had a parcel that she was willing to cut loose. This had led to Heinz meeting Rani. Before the deal was closed, it was clear that a wedding would soon follow. He waxed eloquent over the joys of tractor farming in India, how he was really a very simple man, the joys of watching the growth of a new crop, and so on. He was quite a raver, and I was content to let him spin it all out. It seemed that he was a kind of vice president in charge of operations for the mining concern, a kind of troubleshooter, really. He ordered another beer and told a story about being ambushed by guerrillas during the startup of a big tin extraction operation in northern Thailand. At the story's climax, he stood and lifted his shirt to display for my edification three neat scars across his chest. "From a machine gun," he said. "Any one of them could have killed me outright, but no, I was preserved, and the triumph of our company's project was complete." Describing the startup of a tin mine as a triumph seemed a bit overblown to me, but it was clear that I was in the presence of one intense dude. Hardly pausing, he moved on to the time in Tanzania where he alone, bare-chested and unarmed except for an axe, had strode into a crowd of 6,000 angry workers during a strike at a bauxite operation. Modest, he was not, but the stories were well-told and compelling, and standards for dinner conversation in the warm tropics leave room for the self-aggrandizing traveler's tale. Eventually, he turned his attention to the company he worked for. FEMMI is no ordinary company, Herr McKenna. Please be assured of that. We are like a family. This is the source of our strength, and we have plans for the future. Very big plans, unquote. I only nodded, thinking it best not to inform him that I considered large mining corporations the scourge of the earth. But this devotion to his corporation was no casual matter, and he seemed unable to leave the subject alone. Nowhere on earth is there a more closely knit and dedicated group than are we. We are bound like comrades in arms. Each member of the core management group is a genius in his or her own right, unquote. He pronounced genius like genius, T-C-H-E-N-I-U-S, unquote. Again quoting. And why is that, you must wonder? Ah, I am telling you why. It is because we, each one of us, has known the horror of privation, the depth of despair, and the glorious feeling that comes from overcoming these things. We are united in our triumph, Herr McKenna, and the sense of inevitable conquest of difficulty has made us invincible, unquote. At this last word, his voice rose, and his fist descended to the flimsy table with such force that our quart bottles of Bintang beer jumped in reply. Seeing my uncertain response, he continued, "You are amazed to hear this, I see. Maybe you are asking what privations, what difficulties. It is like this. We all lived through the Hitler times and the war. Germany was nothing after the war. There was not one stone upon another in my native Berlin. In the ruins of Europe, we were like cockroaches. May I tell you that the bank accounts of all the SS families were frozen. My mother, my poor aristocratic mother, was reduced to selling paintings from our estate in order to buy potatoes to feed herself and my younger sister. Imagine this," unquote. Oh, no, I thought. Not Nazis. Is this guy telling me he was a Nazi? I fought to get my look of horror under control, but now he was on a roll and he seemed to take no notice. Quote, "My father was captured by the Russians during the battle for Berlin. He was hung like a dog in Moscow for war crimes. Can you imagine verdammten Russian Schweinen talking about war crimes? For all the SS, it was like that," unquote. This conversation was like a bad dream or a B-movie. I looked over at his companion, who returned my gaze with utter impassivity. It seemed unimportant to deflect the conversation, if only even slightly. "And you, Herr Heinz, what of your role in all of this?" He shrugged. "I was a mere nothing, a Messerschmitt pilot in the Luftwaffe, a good German only," unquote. This last was said without a trace of irony. Quote, "Before the war, I was a young engineering student. The war changed everything. After the war, a few of us, my fellow young scholars from the Max Planck Institute, gathered in the ruins of Berlin. We were finished with ideology, with grand political dreams," unquote. This was the first good news I had heard in a while. I gratefully signaled the Indonesian waiter for another round of beer while Heinz continued, quote, "We were a small group, pitiful, really, but united by our revulsion at the horror all around us. We determined to build a new world for ourselves, a world based on two principles, two great powers, the power of capital and the power of science. We began slowly with patents, processes that had been discovered at the Max Planck Institute during the war, trade secrets, really. Carefully, we expanded on this. We established ourselves in Singapore. There was not a shoemaker among us. Each member of our small team was a genius. Our Führer was a professor who had trained us all, a true genius. His name was Max Bockermann, B-O-C-K-E-R-M-A-N-N. It was he who held us together. It was his faith and strength that made it all possible." The schnitz on his cheek had turned bright red at this turn of the conversation. I had hoped that there were no further depths of discomfiture to be plumbed in this conversation, but I was wrong. For now I saw that he was moving perhaps under the influence of the third quart of Bintang from passionate intensity to outright maudlin sentimentality. Quote, "No man has ever loved another as Bockermann loved us. We are his kinder, his little birds, yeah. When it seemed that there was no hope, he inspired us. He made us believe in ourselves," unquote. Tears rose in his eyes at this. Then he seemed to regain his self-control and continued, "And what is the result? Far East Mining and Minerals Incorporated, Herr McKenna. We have grown and prospered. From our offices in Singapore, we control projects in 11 countries. Oil, nickel, tin, bauxite, uranium. We have it all. But we have more. We have love, companionship, community, and the power to make our dreams come true," unquote. At this, he broke stride and reached over to put his hand on the thigh of the woman beside him. I looked away. When I returned to his depthless blue gaze, his mood had changed. "But what about yourself, Herr McKenna? It is clear that you are leading the gypsy life," unquote. He pronounced the word gypsy like chipsy, C-H-I-P-S-Y. Quote, "And we gypsies always have our stories to tell. So what about you?" Unquote.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
I swallowed hard. He didn't look like the sort of person who would appreciate my stories of fighting the police at the Berkeley barricades. "Last night you spoke of your ambitions to visit the Amazon. This is a commendable dream, but believe me, I know the Amazon well, a jungle the size of a continent. It is not like these islands here. Here you do well to stay with the priests to make your expeditions, 1 week, 2 weeks into the forest. But in Amazon, to do serious work, you will have to sustain yourself in the field for perhaps months. You will need a boat, equipment, and bearers. Believe me, I know, it is not for shoemakers. Therefore, I make you a proposal. You have said your work is nearly completed here, that you are soon going to Japan to earn money for South America. Give up this plan and do instead the following. FEMMI, as it turns out, has a deep interest in the Brazilian Amazon. That's Far East Mining and Minerals Incorporated. 2 years ago, I was part of a resource assessment team that made some interesting discoveries. As it happens, we are sending our people back for a serious second look. Our teams are 13 in number, and some of these are natural scientists such as yourself. The new team is nearly formed, but Bachmann, if he approves of you, would accept my recommendation that you join the team as the 13th member. You will be well paid, and our expectations are only that you would complete the monograph that you have already planned. You see, by having scientists with us, we can write off part of our tax liability, and anyhow, we are believers in the worth of pure science. This plan must be cleared with Singapore, but if they agree, then you would go there nearly immediately. You would meet Berkerman. He would give you a dental checkup, complete physical, new eyeglasses, and 2 weeks of tennis to get you in shape physically. The cruise liner Rotterdam will call in Singapore in 1 month. We will ship 3 speedboats specifically outfitted, all of our equipment, and the team itself on the Rotterdam. In Rio de Janeiro, you will continue training 2 weeks at the Krasnopolsky Hotel, where they have excellent tennis courts. It's K-R-O-S-N-O-P-O-L-S-K-I. Not a Brazilian name, I would note, or a Portuguese name. K-R-O-S-N-O-P-O-L-S-K-I Hotel. And I will tell you something else. My father's old cook is the chef at the Krasnopolsky Hotel. By the way, that would make him an SS cook. We fatten you up some, and then we give you your dream of the Amazon. What do you say? He sat back, evidently very pleased with himself, skipping down after a gathering at the University of Colorado. A full page had been reserved to announce that the University of Colorado, in association with the Max Planck Institute for Neurophysiology, would co-sponsor the next meeting of the World Congress of the Neurosciences, unquote. Skipping down again. As my eyes roved over the crowd, I suddenly experienced something very close to a physical jolt. There, less than 50 feet away from me and nearly directly across the intervening open space, sat Dr. Karl Heinz. I felt absolute amazement. Heinz, here. Could it be? Somehow I must have betrayed my agitation to him, for as I watched in near disbelief, I saw him move his hand to the pocket of his jacket and with a faultlessly smooth motion remove his name tag and drop it into his pocket. He did not even interrupt the animated German conversation he was carrying on with the person sitting to his immediate right. I looked away, trying to pretend that I was unaware of him and had noticed nothing. The house lights dimmed, and Manfred Eigen, E-I-G-E-N, magnificent with his swept-back shock of white hair, began his lecture. My mind raced. Was it all true, then? Here he was. This was a Max Planck Institute event. It must all be true. Skipping down again. As the applause died down and the lights went up, people began to move toward the exits. Heinz was about 50 feet away, talking animatedly to a couple of rather toad-like colleagues. But I could see that he was watching me, and as I began to approach, he excused himself and began to move toward me. It was transparently clear to me that this maneuver was executed to make certain that we would be alone and that our conversation would be unheard when we met. I moved directly into his oncoming path. Dr. Heinz, I believe that we met on Timor. I extended my hand. Ignoring my outstretched hand, he smiled broadly, but the schmiss perceptibly reddened. Heinz? My name is not Heinz, and I have never been in Kupang, unquote. Then he turned quickly and rejoined his departing colleagues, adding to their animated assessment of Eigen's performance. The word Kupang rang in my ears. The bastard was rubbing my nose in it, unquote. And again, that is from the book True Hallucinations by Terence McKenna. There is, in fact, or there was, a cruise ship called the SS Rotterdam. And I would note that the Max Planck Institute, which we're going to talk about some more, was the renaming of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which was not only a major epicenter of German and Nazi science, it had been capitalized by the Rockefeller Foundation and was one of the epicenters of the German eugenics movement and inextricably linked with the Third Reich's extermination programs. In, for the record, 664, we spoke about Josef Mengele and his gruesome experiments on twins at Auschwitz. Those were basically under the auspices of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. Before the twins were experimented on, forms, lengthy forms were filled out and then sent to the Max Planck Institute, Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which was kept abreast of the experiments. After the war, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, rather, was renamed the Max Planck Institute, and some scientists who had been already recruited by Project Paperclip were installed at the Max Planck Institute. And that is where Dr. Karl Heinz was claiming that many of the scientific techniques that were used by his firm were developed during World War II. I will also note that, again, any sort of follow-up to do further research on what Terence McKenna had to say here will be past the point impossible, because Terence McKenna died of a brain tumor shortly after the turn of this century. His papers had been stored at the Esalen Institute down in Monterey, but they were destroyed by a fire, so neither Terence McKenna nor his papers and files are available at this point in time. So again, is this a hallucination or a true hallucination? There is no way of knowing for sure. I would note, though, that the Dr. Heinz, unquote, claimed that the cook at the Konopolsky Hotel in Rio de Janeiro was his father's former cook. His father had been an SS officer. And in the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, he relates a detail about the Bormann Ranch down in Latin America. A bowling alley down one side of the hangar provided about the only recreation. But the SS men I interviewed said that the best German cooking in the world was provided by former SS mess sergeants, and that this was an incomparable feature of the dining room. So was that, was there any relationship between the SS mess sergeants who whipped up first-class cuisine for Martin Bormann and the others on his ranch deep in the Latin American jungles, and the former SS cook, whom Dr. Heinz claimed was the chef at the Konopolsky Hotel in Rio? That, again, is a speculative element. Now, of the Max Planck Institute and its links to the underground Reich, as I call it, from the book Germany, by the way, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is one of the books available on this website for download for free. Another of those is the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Pettens, published in hardcover by Henry Schumann in 1953. And in the latter part of that book, there is the text of a circular letter that was generated by the underground Reich's government in exile in Madrid, Spain. They controlled Germany proper through what was called a Führungsring, a network of control that enabled the Nazi government in exile and beyond that the Bormann Group to control the political affairs of the Federal Republic. And of the Max Planck Institute, we read again from the Madrid circular letter put out by the Nazi government in exile in 1950. Though we are powerless at present, we have nonetheless never permitted ourselves to be disarmed spiritually and scientifically. German scholars are working unremittingly in Germany as well as abroad on great scientific plans for the future. Favorable circumstances enabled us to keep alive the great research organization of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute through a change of name. First-class scientists are working on various fields, chemistry and cosmic rays among them. Our scientists, unhampered in their work, have sufficient time and are planning day and night for Germany's future. It is the German spirit, Geist, unquote, that creates modern weapons, and that will bring surprising changes in the present relationship of forces. So again, the assertion by, quote, Dr. Karl Heinz, unquote, that the Max Planck Institute had continued to provide his organization with the means to steal an enormous march on its competitors in the mining field would appear to be substantiated by the Madrid circular letter. And again, sadly, there can be no follow-up on Terence McKenna's research. He died of a brain tumor maybe 12 years ago, and his files were all destroyed in a fire not too long after that. So was that a hallucination or a true hallucination? Well, you decide. Certainly, the details presented here dovetail with what we know about the Bormann Network. I would also say that that information corresponds quite closely, not only to what Peter Lavenda has revealed to us in his landmark works, but also what is discussed in the book Serpent's Walk, the Nazi Tract that I have alluded to so often. This concludes For the Record program number 870, The Underground Reich in Indonesia. This is being recorded on October 25th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.